Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, February 8th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Holly Pretzky from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now, a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands. Patrick, let's start this week talking about a couple of initiatives to help local police be better prepared and better staffed. Yarmouth police have a new piece of equipment that allows them to practice in lots of different situations. This sounds like a big and maybe a bit scary video game. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is called the Milo Range Simulator, and they've installed it in the basement of the Yarmouth Police Department, the Yarmouth Police Headquarters off Higgins Croll Road. It's a $57,000 simulator, and essentially it's somewhat what you think of with simulators. It's got a screen, and officers can use essentially a simulated gun. They're not allowed to bring their real guns into the simulator. Obviously, there's concern about, you know, mistaking a real gun for a simulated gun. But it also has a lot of bells and whistles, a lot of features, including about 800 scenarios that they can run through. And a trainer who's training an officer who's going through this simulator can kind of adjust as things go along and change the reaction of people on the screen that the officer is looking at. And the important part here is having it locally. The Yarmouth Police Department, as all of your listeners probably know, went through a great deal of mourning last year when they lost an officer who was shot in the line of duty, Yarmouth Police Sergeant Sean Gannon. That was back in April. But what came out of that was this renewed cry for more training. It had been something that Yarmouth Police Chief Frank Fredrickson had been calling for before. This machine was entirely purchased by the Yarmouth Police Foundation, so it wasn't taxpayer money going towards it. It's also part of this larger effort to increase training, a $1.2 million state-of-the-art complex that's planned on the department's grounds. This is the first phase, if you will. But again, as they say, instead of sending officers off Cape or to other locations, they can train them right in-house there, and they can do it on shift. So if somebody's working, they can take 15 minutes out of their shift and train at this facility without really affecting the shift there that much. It also, I think, to me is interesting because somebody who's working, say, a midnight to 8 shift could do it at 7 in the morning, and they might be in the same sort of state, in terms of fatigue or where they are in their day as they might be if they were facing a real situation. So for them, they said this is a really big deal. This is something that's, again, kind of the first phase. They've just installed it and first started using it. Our reporter, Kristen Young, was able to be there and see it in use. And again, they explained that they'd rather have their officers there and make any mistakes there than make any mistakes out in the field. And this is a good way to train them on this.
And Kristen Young's report on this, it's a very vivid description of the kind of scenarios that these officers might face using this simulator, including attempts to create a realistic atmosphere and include distractions to the officers as they're trying to figure out how to respond to these situations.
Yeah, and anybody who's come across a police car on the road at night knows that those, you know, flashing red and blue lights can really be distracting. Noise, other things going on, passing traffic. And the other thing that Lieutenant Kevin Lennon said that he would be doing, and he's trained in this Milo training type of training, he said he'd be maybe even bringing things into the room and putting physical objects in the room that would be a further distraction. But again, the way it works is, you know, even if they're simulating something at night where they're in a building where they flash their flashlight, that's the only place where the screen will light up, for example. So it really gives you some of those realistic feels. And again, this is something that's a trend out there, certainly with mass shootings at schools, the way schools are training with the ALICE training. They're trying to make it more and more realistic because they know that in the event of something happening, they want people to have gone through something similar and it to be as realistic as possible so they're as prepared as possible.
And the idea here is that other departments, police departments through the region will eventually be able to use this too?
Yes, it's primarily for the Yarmouth Police Department, but they did say that it would be available to other departments as well. And, you know, how that works is still to be determined. But there is another effort, as you mentioned, to actually establish a Cape Police Academy.
That's where I'm going next here, yes.
Here on the Cape. And that's interesting. The Barnstable County Commission this week decided to include $50,000 in startup funding for this academy in their proposed budget for 2020. Still has to go through all the process of being approved. But this is separate. This is not, you know, connected directly to the Yarmouth Police Training Facility. But in a way, there are a lot of connections. Yarmouth, former Yarmouth Police Chief Peter Carnes and Wayne Sampson, who was the head of the Massachusetts Chiefs of Police Association, are kind of the two guys who are spearheading this. And they're looking to establish this academy here for some of the same reasons that the Yarmouth Police Department put the simulator and is working on their facility there, because they want officers on the Cape and Islands to be able to come somewhere locally, not have to pay all the expenses of sending somebody off Cape, you know, room and board and food. They can do it locally. They can do it more quickly. But this is more the kind of full police academy, if you will. And otherwise, they'd have to go pretty far afield to do some of this stuff.
This is where they would send recruits that are going to be police officers to be trained in becoming a police officer.
Absolutely. And it includes, you know, classroom instruction. They're looking at a space to have classroom instruction. And they're focusing, I think, on Joint Base Cape Cod as the location for their firearm and emergency vehicle operation training. So some of the things that might go on in terms of the ongoing training taking place at the Yarmouth Police Department with this, their facility, that this would be kind of a bigger type of training that would take place potentially at the Joint Base Cape Cod. And again, they have to meet a lot of standards in order to make this a real police academy. They have to comply with the Massachusetts Municipal Police Training Committee standards. Instructors would have to be certified from that state committee. But instructors would come from local police departments. That's something that they were saying. And the idea there is the folks from local police departments know kind of the lay of the land here. They know how things work here. And it's better to have an instructor who's kind of from your home area telling you how things work rather than somebody who's from further afield.
And police departments on the islands also able to take advantage of this to send their recruits there for training.
Yeah, and Jeff Spillane had talked to, I believe, the Tisbury police chief, who said that, you know, they have that added hurdle of being needing to get on and off the island by ferry or plane. And as we know, that's not always possible, depending on the weather and depending on other things, but is also added time. So having a police academy maybe here on the Cape, they just have to get over to the Cape and it cut the time that then they'd have to travel beyond that. So they really thought from Tisbury, he also spoke to Mashpee Police Chief Scott Carline, and they really thought this was a good idea. There are a lot of details still to be worked out, but they do hope to have it kind of up and running by July, potentially. They still really have to figure out kind of the funding going forward. They have to figure out kind of all the locations for the different training. But both of these efforts are clearly part of a bigger push towards more police training. Obviously, the idea is better trained police are able to respond to situations better and able to escalate or de-escalate a situation depending on what's called for. And I think all the police in particular are looking forward to that.
And they say it may help with recruiting, too, because it makes it easier for the local police departments to recruit from the community and have a local academy to send people to.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's been an issue with police departments, fire departments as well, where they may recruit somebody, they may have somebody who they help train, they help go through the process, and then that person decides maybe it's because of housing costs or other reasons that they're going to take that investment that's been made in them and go elsewhere. The idea here is if you're here being trained on the Cape, it maybe kind of gets you more ingrained in the local community, and you feel more likely that you may be more likely to stay at that point. And again, that's a big deal for them. Each of these classes is about 18 weeks, just so you know, and would be limited to about 40 students. So, you know, it's a crunch to get folks into these classes elsewhere, and this is just another opportunity to get them into classes more locally.
We've got Holly Pretzky joining us on the phone now from the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Holly.
Morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Holly, the Island High School community has been grappling with the issue of sports playing fields. It's been a long and contentious discussion, and now the school committee has weighed in. This has to do in part with a choice between natural and artificial turf. Give us the history here and tell us about this latest decision.
Yeah, so the issue of whether to put synthetic turf athletic fields or natural grass athletic fields on the Martha's Vineyard Regional High School campus has been hotly debated for more than 3 years now. And the school committee took a stand, albeit a divided stand, on Monday night at their meeting. They voted 5-4 to install one synthetic turf field with organic infill material and refurbish 5 natural grass fields. And that plan will cost about $11.3 million and will be completed in phases. And as you said, this issue has been really controversial for several years. Several years ago, one group approached the school committee and said, "Your fields are in terrible shape. We will refurbish them. We will redo them, and we'll do the fundraising. We'll pay for it. And we want them, some of them, to be turf fields." But then another group said, "No, absolutely not. We will redo your fields, and we want them to be natural grass." But talks broke down with both groups, so the school committee at the beginning of last year said, "No, we have to go our own way." They hired their own consultant, and the superintendent at the meeting said this was their independent conclusion, and they had heard input from all sides, and the public had shared their opinions, and this is really what they thought was best for the kids.
And I guess they felt like this was a legitimate compromise. So you still have 5 playing fields with natural grass and you have 1 with synthetic turf.
That's right. A lot of people view it as a compromise. And the people who are in favor of turf are saying, you know, this is about inclusion. This is about having a surface that can handle more use so we can have more Islanders using it. The people who are against artificial turf have said, no, this is a health issue. We're worried about the chemicals that are used to clean plastic fields. We're worried about the material that's used as infill in the plastic fields. And it's also an environmental concern. You know, where will this field go when its natural life is over in 10 years? Will it go to a landfill? Will it be recycled? And this has also kind of touched on that kind of ineffable island identity question. You know, is this vineyard? Mm-hmm. Is the vineyard a place where a synthetic field, a plastic field belongs? So the debate's probably not over. The school committee decided to go with more specific construction plans, but they're going to need building permits from the town of Oak Bluffs, and it'll probably trigger a review from the Martha's Vineyard Commission, which is a regional body that's tasked with preserving that character of the island. So given the amount of passion that was at this meeting, there are 150 people there, 2 hours of public comment. This debate is definitely not over on the island.
Holly, you covered this for the Vineyard Gazette. Underneath the article on the website is the comments section, and there's a lot of comments there, and they reflect that divided opinion, quite passionate, not only between the artificial turf and the natural grass, but also at the price tag of this, $11 million in a time when, you know, schools are looking for every dollar to try to give to the education process.
That's exactly right. And one school committee member in particular brought that up at the meeting. He said the white elephant in the room right now is that we have a $100 million school renovation on the horizon. You know, they've been applying for funding support from the state, from the Massachusetts School Building Authority. They haven't been able to get that support in several years. And so it's looking like the island's going to be kind of on the hook for a really massive renovation to the entire high school campus. So some people are questioning the appropriateness of overhauling the athletic fields at a time when there are other pressing needs. But then at the same time, athletes and coaches are saying, we've been dealing with subpar, unsafe fields for years. The track, it can't be used for official meets because of the condition that it's in.
Holly Pretzky from the Vineyard Gazette. Holly, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks to you.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, we were talking about police training opportunities on the Cape. I want to touch on one more police story here. Two Falmouth officers who were involved in a police shooting last year were recognized this week for their service. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is Officer Donald DeMiranda and Ryan Moore. They were awarded Officers of the Year and the Medal of Honor at a ceremony Tuesday at the Falmouth Police Department. And these are two officers who were shot last year. They did survive that shooting. It took place when they had responded on July 27th to a report of a man breaking bottles. sounded like a routine call. The chief said, talking on Tuesday, said, you know, this sounded like a routine call, but it's just proof that no call is really routine. When they showed up, the person who was breaking these bottles ran into a home, and I believe Officer DeMiranda followed him into the home and was shot actually in the shoulder and chest. But the bullets were stopped by an armored vest. That's according to prosecutors, who said Malik Koval, 21, was responsible for this shooting. He's been charged and arraigned. I think he was arraigned in a hospital in Boston, as a matter of fact. DeMiranda had to go through surgery and stayed hospitalized for a little while. Moore, who was grazed by a bullet as he responded, was treated and released pretty quickly. Both men aren't back on the job at this point, and as Chief Dunn, Edward Dunn from the Falmouth Department, pointed out, you know, the physical wounds have healed, and they are okay physically. Psychologically, he said it takes a bit more time to get back, and he's giving them all the time they need. But they were among a number of officers who were honored by the department for various reasons. And again, some of these may seem a little more mundane than getting shot, but they're the types of situations that officers face every day. And again, goes back to that idea that police believe that more training is necessary so that they're prepared for these situations. But, you know, no matter what you prepare for, when you show up to something that seems like it might be routine, things can escalate pretty quickly, as apparently happened in this case.
We have Tim Wood on the phone with us from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, in coastal communities, the topic of moorings and waterways can provoke some strong opinions. Chatham, not immune to this. The town's been looking at its rules and operations there. Tell us what's happening.
Sure. The town spent about 2 years working on consolidating its various waterways, moorings, and fish pier regulations. This was spearheaded by the Waterways Advisory Committee, and a single document was developed consolidating all these regulations this past August. Those new sort of streamlined regs were adopted by the town's harbor master, who under state law has the authority to promulgate those regulations. Some people, however, of course, weren't happy with what they saw in those new regulations, and suggested that there were some inconsistencies between them and state law and the town's waterways bylaws, which are like a separate set of regulations that are adopted by town meeting. Board of Selectmen decided that this was a complicated issue that they needed some help with, so they hired a legal counsel to review the regulations and waterways bylaws and state law to try to come up with recommendations to ensure that they're all consistent and they all do what they're supposed to do. Last week, that attorney, Amy Kessel of KP Law, heard some concerns of residents as part of a public meeting that she held. And most of those concerns focused on moorings, not surprisingly. Chatham has a lot of moorings, more than 2,500, in a dozen different mooring areas around the town's waterways. And there are also more than 1,000 people on waiting lists to get a mooring. Now, resident Rick Levitt said at that meeting that the mooring regulations need to be changed so that people who don't have a boat on a mooring can't keep them. Right now, if you have a boat and a mooring, you don't necessarily have to keep the boat on a mooring. And he also suggested that in some of the waterways in town, specifically Oyster Pond and Crow's Pond, mooring areas can be expanded beyond their current limitations to accommodate the demand and start whittling down those waiting lists. But that idea didn't sit well with some people, including Cliff Berner of Oyster River Boatyard. He said that those open areas in the waterways are needed because not just for folks who engage in water sports like water skiing and tubing, but also those are places that are sheltered. That's where young boaters learn how to operate a vessel. That's where a lot of families go boating. And a lot of the boatyards use those areas to test out boat repairs and test drive boats rather than taking them out into the open water. And his position was backed up by Harbor Master Stuart Smith, who said there's already a shortage of parking spaces at town landings. For every 10 moorings, for instance, he said there's maybe one parking space. And while he'd really like to add more moorings, you know, start getting rid of those waiting lists, he said that would really tax the town's waterways And his quote was, he doesn't think residents really want to develop the waterways as intensely and densely as they've allowed the town's real estate to be developed. Now, the attorney said she will take those comments in and will deliver a report, she said, fairly soon to the Board of Selectmen. They will then decide if there's any action to be taken, which could include modifying some of those waterways bylaws at this year's annual town meeting.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, some good news in local health care. Residents on the Cape are going to have access to top treatments for cancer through a new collaborative.
Yeah, this is a partnership between Cape Cod Hospital and Dana-Farber. Cape Cod Hospital has become part of the Dana-Farber Cancer Care Collaborative. And what this does, according to hospital officials who kind of feted this collaboration earlier this week, is it formalizes second opinion services with Dana-Farber. Dana-Farber is known for their work in cancer treatment, obviously. And it allows Cape patients and doctors to take advantage of Dana-Farber's clinical trials and tumor board reviews. They're the sixth hospital to join the collaborative since it started about 3.5 years ago. And again, the importance here from Cape Cod Hospital's perspective and Cape Cod Healthcare, which is the parent company's perspective, certainly is that they can keep patients here on the Cape. People know Boston. They know the hospitals up in Boston are known for their work in various fields, including cancer. But instead of traveling to Boston, they can get some of those services that are available via Dana-Farber here on the Cape. They did have to go through a pretty vigorous vetting process, according to officials. They had to make sure that the Hyannis Hospital met criteria for chemotherapy treatment, nursing, pharmaceutical care, and facilities management, among other things. And again, it'll allow kind of this consultation to be certainly formalized. It might have taken place at some level before, but to be pretty formalized. And again, the importance is the number of patients who are receiving care off Cape, according to Michael Loff, he's the CEO for Cape Cod Healthcare, is about 30%. So that's 30% of, Cape patients who are going off Cape. But there are more than 22,000 cancer patients being served by Cape Cod Healthcare annually, he said. That's a big number, obviously, and if you're able to get some of those services without going over the bridges, that's a big deal. Loff also did say that this was kind of just the start, that there are going to be a lot more announcements coming forward, so we'll certainly look forward to those and find out what they are and report them as they happen.
You can imagine if, as you're dealing with cancer, if you don't have to make that trip to Boston nearly as often because you can get those services here, that's an important step forward for lots of folks.
Yeah, you would definitely think so. Even going to the doctor, period, can be, even if it's local, can be a long period of time that's taken to drive to do it to Boston. It extends that time, obviously.
Ed Miller joins us from the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Ed, Provincetown is having a special election to fill a select board seat, and there are two candidates running for the open seat, and both are well-known in the town. Tell us about what's happening here.
Yes, it's an unusually fascinating contest. This is a special election to fill a vacant seat that was created when Tom Dunnigan unexpectedly resigned in December. His term expires in June, so it's just a fairly short time that this election is for. But the two candidates are Michaela Carew Murphy, who manages a restaurant here that's owned by her mother. The restaurant is Sal's Place, very well known here in town. And she's running against John Golden, who is a longtime member of the Provincetown Planning Board, and also has served on the Community Engagement Committee and worked for the AIDS Support Group. Carew Murphy, who is exactly half the age of Golden, she's 31 and he's 62. She, even though she doesn't really have much experience as in town government, she is an alternate on Historic District Commission, but she says that she has degrees in economics and law. from the London School of Economics and from University College Cork in Ireland. She grew up in Ireland and went to high school in Dublin. Her mother, incidentally, Siobhan Carew, owns three very popular restaurants in Boston, Pomodoro in Boston and Brookline, and Matt Murphy's Pub. But the Sal's Place has been embroiled for several years in controversy here in town. Because of some questionable statements that Carew Murphy had made in the context of that whole controversy, she claimed to have been assaulted at one point, but her claims were not supported by a police report. We went ahead to check out her her statements about her education, and we heard back from the London School of Economics that they had no record of her having been a student there. And so when we asked her about that, she said that she went to the school under a different name, but she wasn't going to tell us what that name is. That's one interesting part of the race. For Golden's part, he also has been criticized for some of his behavior when he was chair of the planning board. Another member of the board, Grace Ryder O'Malley, has said that he really did not do a very good job as chair and did not support the other members and contributed to some unfortunate events there. There were a number of controversial cases before the planning board over the last few years. Both of these people are interesting, I think, because of they're both working people. A lot of town officials out here, especially with our aging population on the Outer Cape, tend to be retired people. Both of these are working people. Carew Murphy manages the restaurant, also has a babysitting service, and Golden is a wallpaper hanger who works both in Boston and in on the Outer Cape. One question for Golden is that he actually commutes back and forth between Boston and Provincetown, and there's some question, you know, with if how is that going to work with if as a member of the Board of Selectmen. He says that he works for himself and he's able to arrange his schedule as he needs to so that he can be here when if necessary. Anyway, there's going to be a candidates event on Monday, sponsored by the Banner at Provincetown Town Hall at 4:30 p.m. and the two candidates have agreed to participate and face off against each other. So it should be quite interesting. The election's on Thursday, February 21st.
Ed Miller, the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thanks for joining us with that.
A pleasure. Thanks, Steve.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. In a story that's been developing for some time now, the town of Yarmouth has gone forward and sued its own school district, the Dennis Yarmouth Regional District, over a vote to go ahead with a new middle school. Tell us about this development.
Yes, and they also sued the town of Dennis. We had known this lawsuit was basically coming, kind of the exact nature of it and content of it. We didn't know until it was officially filed. But essentially, Yarmouth is suing and saying that the vote that took place, which was at a district-wide election with the two towns involved, was not legitimate. And they're saying that state law or a clause in the regional school agreement stipulates that the district has to go through a certain section of state law, which means that they have to go to town meeting in each town to take an action on something like this. School committee, when they went forward with this in July, instead went through a different process that's outlined in state law, which provides for this district-wide election type vote. And so this lawsuit's now been filed, and obviously Yarmouth and Dennis, as your listeners may remember, are embroiled in this discussion about funding the shared regional school district there on the operational budget level. But this move to build a new middle school, which a lot of people say is needed. They have a couple of older middle schools, and it would replace both those, the Nathaniel H. Wixon Middle School and the Mattakese Middle School. Mattakese in particular has been plagued by a lot of problems in terms of the physical school itself. And they say this will replace both those schools, put it on a location on Station Avenue, a little more centrally located. And it's a $117 million school. Some of that money, about $40 million, would be paid for by the state through the Massachusetts School Building Authority, $44 million, I think it is. And that money is now in jeopardy with this lawsuit, because even though a couple of people, including Yarmouth's own attorney, have looked at this lawsuit and said, well, it's probably not a winner in terms of the lawsuit, because for one reason in particular, the Department of Education at the state level had come out and interpreted the law to say that they should go through the election way that the school committee did it, and that was the proper way to do it. And courts generally give great deference to agencies in their interpretation of these types of laws. But even if they don't win the lawsuit, the school district has stopped work on this regional middle school. And the building authority, the state building authority, has basically said, yeah, you're not going to be able to go forward with this if that, obviously, we're not going to be able to provide the money for this if that vote wasn't official and in the middle of this kind of litigation. They may have gotten a little bit of a reprieve on a deadline where they need to sign a letter of commitment for that money. But it really does tie things up at a couple different levels. A, if the lawsuit is successful, you know, it certainly would overturn that vote. And the two towns voted very differently. Dennis voted largely in favor on their side, and Yarmouth voted against it. Again, all the votes were combined, and that's how you ended up with the very narrow victory. I think it was 25 votes in total after a recount for that election. But again, even if that lawsuit isn't successful, it could cause a problem by way of having to commit to this money from the state. If they don't get the money from the state, it seems pretty difficult for them to move forward with this project.
But the larger issues would still remain that the school, a middle school, has to be either created or the two separate middle schools have to be renovated, and that's a lot of money there. And they're going to lose, they have stand to lose all this money from the state if they push forward with all of that. Is that right?
That is absolutely true, and there doesn't seem like a real good win here, because even setting aside the middle school project, as I said, there's these underlying questions and issues with the way the schools are just funded at an operational level on an annual basis, and those have not gone away. Those that dispute where Yarmouth is seeking to have Dennis pitch in more has not gone away. Again, it should be noted that the way the formula is set up now was something that Yarmouth had pushed for in the past, and then it started to shift in a direction that made it difficult for Yarmouth. They've had to seek some overrides over the years. There was had to be a what's called the big tent meeting, where they had to fund the schools via a meeting with both towns involved. So those underlying issues in terms of how that regional formula is set up and how they fund the schools are still going to remain, even if you figured out this physical school question, the capital project here. But the capital project itself seems to be in doubt at this point.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. With me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And joining us on the phone right now is George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, Menemsha Market, which is an island landmark, won't be opening this summer because of a recent fire. You've got a nice profile of the two brothers whose family owned and operated it for many years, even back when it was also a post office.
That's right. This is the Seward brothers. This is David and Doug, and Rich Salzberg talked to them and did a great story about the history of Menemsha Market. Unfortunately, it comes out of this horrible situation where there was a fire there, and they're not going to be able to open for the season. But he went back and he talked to them, and they're among the remaining, they call them crickers, in Menemsha, people who really know the history there. And it's just a great story about how the Menomshan Market was once featured on Saturday Evening Post, and
a whole cover of the Saturday Evening Post was a painting of the Menomshan Market.
That's right. It was a painting, and it's really a quite striking painting. And interestingly, they owned it for a certain period of time, and then put it up for auction. Someone came back to the store years later and said, "Hey, we have a painting of this," and they said, "Yeah, we know. We're the ones who sold it to you, basically." But it went for a lot of money as well at auction. I think it was like $167,000 that particular painting went for at a Texas auction house back in 2015. So, yeah, pretty iconic place. And, everybody's a little bit sad that it's not going to be able to open this summer, but hopefully they'll be able to do the work and get it back up and running as soon as possible.
I also want to ask you about a story we talked about last week with Brian Dowd about a restaurant owner on island who's a big football fan who now has to pay off a debt after the Patriots won the Super Bowl by more than 4 points.
That's right. That's J.B. Blau, and he's the owner of Sharky's Cantina. As listeners might remember, he took to Facebook back in December when things were looking pretty bleak. Have to admit, as a Patriots fan, I was doubting myself. And so he put a little something on Facebook and asked people to like it, and many people did. It was about the Super Bowl, and it's ended up costing him about $30,000, he estimates, in gift cards to his restaurant. Brian Dowd is the one who wrote our story, and Gabrielle Menino was the photographer. They both watched the Super Bowl with JB close by at Sharky's Cantina, and he was taking it all in good spirits that night. He even gave away some of his memorabilia from other Super Bowls, handed out a ring he had from Super Bowl 51 and also a watch that he had. So JB's taking it all in stride, and all's well that ends well. The Patriots won, of course.
Yeah, he refused to say that he lost the bet. He said he won because the Patriots won, and he had all these folks turn out, and it was a great community-building exercise.
That's right. He really wanted them to win, and he was happy at losing $30,000.
Hey, quickly, before we let you go, you've got a story about another big change on the island. A beloved chocolatier is closing its doors.
That's right. This is Chilmark Chocolates. This is a breaking news story yesterday afternoon. Amazing people reacting over here. It's palpable. Our Facebook post, we got 37,000 people. It's reached at this point. 291 people have shared it. Many, many sad emojis. Almost everybody to a person saying that they're going to miss Chilmark Chocolates. It's a much beloved business. They are going to close at the end of 2019, and they're not going to sell the business. They're just going out at the top of their game.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve. Take care.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times is with us. Patrick, the offshore wind company Vineyard Wind took another significant step toward building its wind farm as the state gave its approval for it to seek local permits for bringing this power cable ashore.
And just real quick before we move on, Steve, I can't believe George didn't call that a bittersweet story. That was right there for you, George. Just kidding.
Melt in your mouth, yes.
Exactly. Vineyard Wind, as a lot of people will remember, had won a contract to sell 800 megawatts of wind energy to three electric distributors, and they're going through the process of permitting this project. And recently, the state's top environmental chief, Matthew Beaton, who's the Secretary of Energy and Environmental Affairs, signed off on a certificate that essentially allows them to move forward with local and regional permitting, including with the Martha's Vineyard Commission. I believe they have to go to the Cape Cod Commission. This is a project that obviously has a regional effect here, and primarily not necessarily because of the wind turbines out at sea, but because of the cable that's running ashore. The Edgartown Conservation Commission had referred this to the Martha's Vineyard Commission. They're like the Cape Cod Commission here on the Cape, deal with regional projects, projects that have regional effects. And so these two undersea cables would have to run through, I think, about 23 miles of state waters. And they're looking at everything, you know, the environmental effects, the effects during the installation of the cables. And Beaton's certificate essentially said you can move forward with that permitting, but there are a number of things that you really should address as you do so. And these include better protection for piping plovers at Covell Beach, which is in Barnstable, where the cables are intended to come ashore. There's two different alternatives. That's become the preferred alternative. Originally, it was through Lewis Bay to Yarmouth, but there was some pushback there, and I think the company decided that Covell Beach, and in a deal with the town of Barnstable, went forward with the Covell Beach as the preferred alternative at this point. They have to worry about noise. They have to worry about a number of effects, and they also have to are expected, according to the certificate, to pay up some money to, under the State Oceans Act, about $240,000. And then they have a fee also for tidelands occupation. That'll be determined after the construction is completed. So this certificate really lays out kind of the next steps for them. Again, they have a number of permitting hurdles to get over, but it does really indicate that this is moving forward. People will remember Cape Wind and Nantucket Sound closer to shore, a lot more angst and concern about that project. Not that there isn't concern about Vineyard Wind. Fishermen have expressed some concern. They've been working with fishermen, I think, out of New Bedford primarily to try and figure out ways to mollify some of those concerns. But it does seem to be clicking along at a more rapid pace and a more easy pace than Cape Wind, which obviously never went forward and ended up failing in the end. This one seems to be moving more in the direction of being a success. So they're going to have a number of public meetings coming up. The Federal Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has one starting on Monday on Nantucket for the draft environmental impact statement for the project. And then the Cape Cod Commission is expected to open a public hearing within 45 days of this certificate, which was issued February 1st by Beaton's office. So a lot more to come, but again, seems to be moving forward. And that's despite the government shutdown, which did cause some of these meetings to be delayed.
A new audit is faulting the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe's accounting practices, and there's a lot here that was criticized.
Yeah, this is a new old audit, if you will. It's an audit that was from the year 2016 in terms of the time it covered, but it really just was sent to the tribal council on June 27th by Arizona-based Walker and Armstrong, and this was a firm essentially
by January 27th.
June 27th.
Okay.
Yes. No. This wasn't released recently. It became apparent to us recently, again looked back at 2016, but in the context of where the tribe is now with its proposed casino project in Taunton and their struggle to kind of secure their reservation lands, it certainly seemed relevant to us. Obviously relevant to look at how their finances have been going, because they are currently deeply in debt to a international gaming developer, Genting Malaysia, which has been backing their efforts to build this casino. And then they ran into, again, real quick rundown, ran into legal problems when neighbors of this proposed Taunton Casino sued successfully. A judge remanded the decision to take land into trust for the tribe where this casino would be located in Taunton back to the Interior Department. The Interior Department decided that they couldn't move forward with finding that the tribe qualified for this land in trust. The tribe has sued back and sued, I think, the Interior Department at this point over that decision. There's a bill in Congress that Representative William Keating from our area is championing that is facing an uphill battle, because there are a lot of interests out there. Rhode Island legislators, Connecticut legislators, obviously other casinos who see this as competition are all kind of against this bill. So it is a high hurdle for this bill to go forward, which would clear the way for the land to be taken into trust, clear the way for the casino project, which is a $1 billion casino project, to move forward. In any case, this audit from, again, a period in 2016, the year 2016, looked at the internal controls that the tribe has over its finances, and it pointed out deficiencies and weaknesses in those internal controls, including accounting practices and procedures that are more than a decade out of date, discrepancies in the pay rate of employees, lack of regular inventory of capital assets. And a lot of these issues that the auditor pointed out, they said really raised questions about whether the tribe is open to fraud and theft, really, including kind of some basic stuff like keeping stocks of checks in unlocked cabinets during the day and signature stamps used to sign checks not kept in a secure location, kind of creating these opportunities. It's important to point out that they said that they didn't find any financial improprieties or any fraud or theft or anything that they were looking at. But they were really looking at the controls and saying, you know, it's open to this idea. We, reporter Tanner Stenning talked to somebody who's kind of an expert in accounting, and he said, yes, this doesn't say there was fraud that was committed or anything that was done wrong, but the controls that are in place kind of leave them open to that. Again, all within this context of this mounting debt that they have for this casino. The tribe's not going to be responsible for that debt necessarily if the casino project doesn't go forward. But even this audit pointed out that they could be responsible for some of the land issues and some of the debt on the land that they've purchased for that project.
And it also comes to light here at a moment when, in the last couple of weeks, the tribal council has been, took away the fiduciary powers from Chairman Cedric Cromwell, and now you're reporting that they've given them back, but there's some question about how it's being managed in that way.
Yeah, and this was a real reversal. About 3 weeks ago, we had done some reporting, again, Tanner had done some reporting on some financial troubles that the chairman had himself. He and his wife, Cheryl Cromwell, owed $37,000 in back taxes. And again, people can say, you know, this is a personal matter, but when you're leading an organization that has such wide-ranging effects on the community, on the tribe itself, and the potential, if they're successful, there's millions of dollars that are going to be flowing through the tribe through this casino project. If they're not successful, you're going to have all sorts of ramifications. They're already laying people off, 31 people last year and more coming this year because of the tightening of the budget. In any case, they are going through a divorce. We looked at some of those papers, again, not to look at their divorce, but to look at the financial aspects of how the chairman has been handling his own personal finances. If he's in charge of these larger financial issues, it really does raise a lot of questions. The tribal council about 3 weeks ago stripped Cedric Cromwell of his financial powers, also voted no confidence in him just on Wednesday, and they released a statement yesterday saying that they had reversed those votes. So they said they looked at the evidence, and they kind of pointed out leaks to the media and enemies that they think are coming after them. Quite honestly, the documents we were looking at weren't leaked to us. They were documents that were in the public sphere. They were either, whether you look at the $37,000, that's a lien that the federal government put on them. That's public documents. The divorce proceedings are public documents. The audit itself that we were just discussing is actually a public document. It didn't have to be. The tribe apparently could have opted out of making this public, but it was posted to a federal website. So all these documents are out there for anybody to see, which is different from a lot of what you see with the tribe, because a lot of their documents are not public.
And Patrick, we've got just about a minute here, but before we go, I want to switch gears and ask you about a story Cindy McCormick did. Officials have been getting some calls recently about seals that people feared were in distress. Turns out they're just doing what seals do.
Yeah, and this is not necessarily unusual this time of year. Seals coming ashore on beaches or on the ice, and people see them and well-meaning make phone call to police or somebody and say there's a seal. It may be in distress. In some cases, it may be, but in most cases, experts say that these seals are just coming onto the beach, hauling out, as you will, to rest. And anybody who goes near them or tries to feed them or tries to pet them is just causing them more stress and is also maybe in danger of getting bitten themselves. So they say if you think a seal's in distress, you can call this hotline for the International Fund for Animal Welfare, 508-743-9548, if you want the number. But otherwise, just leave them alone. It's not unusual for them to be out this time of year, especially some young seals whose regular haulouts may not be available because of rough weather or something. They've checked on some of these seals. In most cases, they're all right. In one case, they'd had a laceration. They're monitoring that seal. But this isn't a real cause for concern and isn't necessarily unusual. Obviously, we have a lot of seals around Cape Cod, up to 50,000, according to experts. So it's maybe not unusual. Maybe you're seeing them in some places where they weren't before as they're spreading out. But them coming ashore and hauling out, it really isn't something to be concerned about.
That's what they do.
Yep, chilling out.
That's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest from the Cape Cod Times, Patrick Cassidy. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
And we heard from Holly Pretzky at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.